Okay, welcome back to Jump Scare. I'm Chad Youngblood.
And I'm Betty.
And we're here today with Micah Gallo, the director of Itsy Bitsy.
Yeah.
Who's showing here at this weekend at the Popcorn Frights Festival and in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, world premiere. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Likewise, thank you for coming. Thank you. So it's a world premiere of this tonight.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about Itsy Bitsy.
Yeah, well, it's been, I've been working on this project off and on for probably 10 years. So it's like the culmination of a long haul. And really, over the past 3 years is kind of what it took to make it. And so we're excited to premiere it tonight. And, you know, I think the genre fans here seem really fun. The programming is really great at Popcorn Frights. And I think it's going to be a fun audience.
Yeah. Now, you've worked a lot in visual effects over the years.
Yep.
And does it help to have had that visual effects background to be directing a movie that's going to be, you know, rely on effects and all that?
It helps. I don't know if it makes it any easier, but it definitely helps to kind of know how you plan it and what you need to do, because certainly as an indie filmmaker, you have to take responsibility for that. If you're working with a lot of effects, no, it's like every other aspect of indie filmmaking. No one's going to care as much as you. No one's going to put the thought process into it that you are. So yeah, we had to plan it out very carefully. I don't know if it's interesting for your interview, but I mean, we had spreadsheets upon spreadsheets where we're tracking status of shots over a weekly basis, and you have to send back notes that have, notations to the frame that you're drawn in, and so they know exactly what they need to do. But what's interesting about our film is most of it's practical. And so that, even when I did visual effects, we always recommended that to indie filmmakers. You start practically because visual effects are essentially a expensive cartoon.
Yeah.
And so if you want your thing to look like a cartoon, which some people do, then visual effects are great. If you want it to look realistic, we find that at least on indie movies, it's better to start with something real. And that way you're seeing something, you know, and you see the way light hits it and stuff like that. You're not having to fake reality. You're starting in a real place. And then we just use visual effects to augment what's not working. So if you need a little more life to something, we add that.
Okay.
And even with that, we did a lot of practical elements, meaning that we would shoot something real, and then even though we're using digital compositing, it's still two real things that we put together.
Well, that's great, because I always think that is the better way to do it. It looks more realistic. If you can tell the difference when an actor is actually holding something and someone is drawing it in later.
Right.
So that always makes it so much better. It just feels more realistic. You can feel the... when they're getting attacked, you feel it more than it's just...
Absolutely, yeah, I feel that way.
Yeah, definitely, in their expressions and how they're reacting to it, because something in a green screen, you know, maybe there's like a ball that they have to follow.
You got it.
You're going to get more of organic, especially, I mean, there's two kids in the film, so like that's going to be more real to them, and you're going to get that organic response from everyone involved. And there are recognizable like faces in this movie. You have Denise Crosby and Bruce Davidson that are in the film.
Yep.
So how is it working with those kind of like, you know, actors that have been in like a plethora of like movies?
It was great. It really upped everyone's game. You know, having Bruce and Denise there, they were both very committed to their roles and really brought something that, you know, it's easy for actors of their ilk to kind of come on and say, oh, I'm doing this little movie and I'm going to phone it in. You know what I mean? And you see it happen all the time in indie movies, and they didn't do that. They really cared about the characters the same way we did, and it's infectious. It's sort of like everyone on the crew steps it up, every one of the other actors step it up, because they see the commitment that those actors are putting into it, and it just makes the characters better, which I think makes a movie that you have more of a chance of people wanting to watch it again, hopefully, because, you know, the performances are strong. Yeah.
I have to say, as someone, when I saw the trailer, I was already, my hands were already over my face closing my eyes, because I kind of have like a mild arachnophobia. So I'm just already like, oh my God, I'm totally fucking scared already of these fucking spiders. Especially that scene where she's like in the bathroom in front of the mirror, and the, you know, the camera is just telling the story, pulls back, and you see the spider waiting for her behind the curtain, and you're like, oh my God. What the fuck is going to happen? Is it something that, are you afraid of spiders, or the other two writers that co-wrote the film with you?
Oh, definitely.
Like,
yeah.
Where did that this idea come from for Itsy Bitsy?
Well, when I was a kid, when I used to pray at night, I'd pray that spiders wouldn't come and bite my toes in the middle of the night. don't know how I came up with that, but that was what I was afraid of.
It's a legitimate fear.
Yeah, I felt so at the time. And yeah, you know, it's just one of those things where as I started studying it too, I'd look at spiders under a magnifying glass and it's horrifying. It looks like an alien creature from outer space when you really look at it.
Yeah.
And so my original idea was to have this very specific size where you could see those details, but not too big so it could still hide under things and behind things and behave the way that a real spider would. So, you know, we wanted it to have that believability because let's face it, like those touchstones, right, of like a little web strand hitting you or smashing a spider and suddenly it's gone. It's like these are things that people experience with spiders. And so we wanted to have that reality in it, at least a plausibility that, you know, helped people connect with that fear in a real way.
Now, unfortunately, we have not been able to see the movie. We will be very shortly going in to see the film. Do you think that this is something that is going to, like, tap into, like, deep-seated fears for the audience? Are you one of those that are going to, like, probably sit in the back of the audience just to see the overall, like, response from the people in the audience?
I'll be there. And look, it's always torturous watching. I mean, it's, like, partly joyous to see everything culminate and to see people be able to like celebrate and jump in the right moments. And then there's something torturous about having to watch it for the 100,000th time or whatever it's been that I've seen it. But yeah, it'll be fun. And I've seen it with smaller groups of like 5 or 10 people. And so, yeah, I know that people look at each other in the gross out moments and make little faces. And I know they jump a good 5, 6 times. So I know those things work. And what I hope though, you know, is it's a character drama too. And so I worry that people who've just seen the trailer think it's going to be like nonstop action. And let's, you know, look, it would have been impossible on our budget to do that at the level that of quality that we wanted. If they gave me like 3 to 5 times more money next time, I could absolutely make that movie 100%. But we focused on our characters and we wanted to make that connect. So that's why we kind of say it's like, it's got some of the fun aspects of something like Jaws, but then it's got like an edgy character drama, more like The Exorcist. But it's really also kind of like, if you're familiar with Q, the Winged Serpent, or like Of Unknown Origin, where it's sort of like you have this psychological link almost between the character drama and the creature, to where the creature is the catalyst that makes the person have to deal with whatever it is they're dealing with. And so that's sort of what the movie is at its core.
Yeah, we really appreciate films that actually have character development because it's so lost now within the horror genre. It's all just about let's have all these jump scares and let's have, you know, these certain like tropes of horror and then people just eat it all up. And it's like, what about the people that actually want an actual movie where you can take away something from it? You're like, it's about the experience of this family dealing with this or this person and how they're going through it. And having kind of like a backstory so you have more of an overall view of like these are actual people that are going through this. This is just not like some chick running through the woods going, you know, hiding, you know, getting away from this killer. Yeah. And we don't know anything about her. She gets killed. You don't care about her.
Right.
So we really appreciate that.
Good.
Watching films that have that. So I'm very excited that you actually said that because that's exactly what we look for and what we think makes a good horror film.
Yeah, that's how we felt too. You know, we kind of like as writers, we're looking at movies that we like and what brings us back to them. And, you know, with the exception of maybe something like Evil Dead 2 that's so visually imaginative that you come back for that, for us, it's usually the characters. It's usually like there's something about the characters that at least drive the emotions that we feel or we want to hang out with those people again. And that sort of makes it worth going back. So we wanted that connection.
Yeah, well, if you think, you watch some of the older movies, like the original Halloween, there's not that many people killed in the movie.
Right.
There's only like 3 or 4 people actually killed in the movie, but in the others, even in the sequels to it, they keep upping the body count on it.
Right, it became like, a body count thing. Yeah, and you're absolutely like, right.
You know, I would rather have 3 or 4 scenes that you care about the people, as opposed to just, you know, oh, here we killed 12 people in imaginative ways.
Yeah.
It's much more effective to just get a few people in there and where you really care about them when something happens.
Yeah. When I you know, I've always been into surreal horror. I like things that are imaginative or bizarre. You know, I've always had a death obsession since I was 5 years old. I don't understand why we have to die. And it's just like really interesting to me when someone does something imaginative, like Hellraiser, or Nightmare on Elm Street, like you say, that's more suspense. I mean, even Hitchcock, you know, playing with ideas and pushing people's buttons and leaving some of it up to the imagination, I think sometimes can be as powerful as that stuff. Because, yeah, I mean, I could talk a long time about what happened in the 80s and 90s, because that slasher film transitioned over to American action movies. And you see these... What are they? They're slasher movies. It's basically a guy who's going around killing a bunch of people.
He's just using a gun.
And it's, yeah, and it's as much of a body count thing as anything else, right? And it's sort of that, that's peaked.
Yeah.
I think, you know, with maybe a few exceptions, maybe there's something else that can be done with it. But let's face it, a lot's been done with the slasher genre. But, you know, when people come up with something new, even if it's from their own fears, that excites me. I like kind of exploring other people's fears and fascinations.
Yeah, like you said, it's a lot of the movies too. What you didn't see was scarier than what you did, what you would see. You know?
Oh yeah,
because
yeah.
your mind fills in the blank, and it's 100 times worse. It's was a scene in the Dead Zone where you don't actually see it happen, but he puts the scissors on the tub and then leans forward like he's going to smash. You don't see it,
yeah,
but your mind fills in the blanks that
absolutely.
You just saw that horrible thing happen. And
yeah,
it's way worse.
Well, I remember I had a babysitter describe to me what happened in It, you know, the original TV series. I mean, I saw it later, and it's scary, it's fun, you know, when you're a kid, but the way she described it to me gave me nightmares for months. You know, like, she described it so vividly that my imagination took over, and it was absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, your own imagination will fill in those blanks so much. Not that it's not great to see the stuff on screen.
Yeah.
But it can be overdone.
Absolutely. It's a balance, right? It's like, but, you know, ultimately, horror has to be mysterious, and once it loses that sense of mystery, it ceases to be scary in a certain respect. And so, you know, people who, there's this tendency now, not in it with everyone, but there's a tendency to over-explain things.
Yeah.
And it's a real delicate balance, because it's like, if you over-explain it too much, it's no longer frightening. It doesn't have that air of mystery.
It doesn't have the edge to it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask my one last question, unless you have something
else.
No,
go ahead.
My question is, if you could be anyone from any horror universe or part of a horror universe, what movie would that be?
It would definitely be Nightmare on Elm Street. That's like, that one just set my imagination on fire when I saw it. And I mean, I was too afraid of horror movies growing up to watch them. Like, I remember someone had the thing on videotape when I was a kid, and I sat in front and pretended to watch it, but I was in front so no one could see that I had my eyes closed during all the scary parts.
That's great.
And I suddenly had to go to the bathroom, so I mean, I didn't know what happened in that movie for years. But when I finally saw Nightmare on Elm Street, which was like in high school or closer to high school, I mean, that just emblazoned me with a love of horror movies that hasn't stopped since.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to head very soon to go see Itsy Bitsy, and we really appreciate you speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and for everyone else, it's coming out August 30th.
Okay.
In limited, very limited theatrical and VOD, and then the Blu-ray comes out October 1st, and it's going to have commentaries and all kinds of fun stuff.
Just in time for Halloween.
Yeah, exactly.
Great, I love it. I'm so glad that it's actually going to be like released in all those different ways.
Yeah.
You know, you can like, okay, if you didn't catch it here, you will be able to catch it. Because sometimes it just depends on, you have to wait a little while.
Right.
To, you know,
yeah, windows
see it and all that. So that's great.
And it's good to get an actual Blu-ray release of it, because I like to actually have the copies of everything.
Yeah.
Because I don't like to just have the digital version of it, because they can pull that away at any time.
I feel the same way. Yeah, I still have all my Blu-rays, and no one understands why, and sometimes I wonder why, but I love it. I love having physical media, especially when, you know, I'm glad that it's a company like Shout Factory, because they put the extras on it.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, as a collector, that's what you want. You don't want what some of these big studios do now, where they have like a 2-minute clip, and that's like the one. Well, why would you buy that?
Yeah.
There's no reason. There's nothing.
There's
extra,
no reason. Yeah.
Yeah. You remember the days of like the Laserdiscs when they first came out, and they were
an early DVD.
With all this stuff. Yeah.
Anchor Bay was killing it, like
bringing
out all these cool old movies I had never seen.
Anchor Bay even did it on the VHS things for a while. Remember when they came
out
with the
those
double clamshell
tapes?
Yeah, the
limited
double
edition.
Tapes.
Yeah.
Had all the, like, at the end of the movie, it would have the deleted scenes and everything.
Yeah.
I was eating that up. And
I was too.
And then switched to DVDs and all that, and now it's kind of tapered off. So I'm glad to hear, like, Shout Factory is a great place to get all those kind of features.
Yeah, they're kind of unique in that way, in that they understand the collector mentality and respect you know, the genre.
Yeah, like I said, it's nice to be able to listen to the commentary on it and hear what's going on and all that, instead of just having just the same plain movie and that's it.
Yep.
All right, well, thank you again for coming out and talking to us.
Hey, thank you.
We can't wait to go see the movie now.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
All right, thank you for joining us, guys, and stay tuned to the horror.
Hi, welcome back to Jump Scare. We're here today at Popcorn Fries again with my co-host, Betty B. Deadly.
Hi.
And we're talking with Adam Egypt Mortimer, whose film, Daniel Isn't Real, we just got out of the screening of.
Yeah. Hi.
How are you doing
today? Thanks for having me. I'm good, man. I'm warm. I'm warm and cozy in the swamp heat.
Yeah.
And I'm warm and cozy with everybody's love. It felt, you know, it was a really great crowd.
It was a great screening. It went over very well.
Yeah.
I guess the first question I got for you is, so you ended up with the son of Tim Robbins,
yeah,
and the son of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I know,
it's
so strange. It's so strange. I know.
How did
I
mean, come about?
Miles, I cast because I had seen him in Blockers, and I thought he was so funny, and like, it just has this energy. And so I met him, and he understood the movie on such a deep sort of philosophical level, and had like this incredible ability to be the character. And Patrick, for the character of Daniel, had to be somebody who was like beyond human and how good looking he, like, right? Like, this character has to be like so charming and handsome, and you want to be him. And I was like, I really want to make a movie where the men, these young men, are just so attractive, and I need good shirtless shots and any cheekbones, and there's very few people, you know, who can look like that and can sort of have this like commanding performance, and I think, you know, and also honestly, you know, be attractive to financiers.
Yeah.
So you're sort of you're like, are we going to cast these like movie stars who are in X-Men movies? Are we going to cast Spider-Man? You know, no, we're not. We're not going to get those guys. But you know, Patrick, because of his background and his name, he's got this kind of excitement that people might want to see what he's doing in a movie just based on kind of his name and based on his, I mean, every day, you know, just Jared reports on what kind of Frappuccino he's drinking. He's one of those, you know, and I think having that kind of background, like, he's a Kennedy. He's not just Arnold's son. He's also a Kennedy. He goes to the Kennedy, you know, family reunion every year.
Yeah.
So all of that, like, DNA to play this character who's this, like, you know, kind of psychological, cosmic, handsome entity. It's very hard to find the right person.
Well, he did a great job.
Yeah, he's an American royal. I mean, if you think about it.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly
so,
right.
He,
like, he's got this kind of
way.
Yeah, it's more than just celebrity, right? It becomes royalty, which
totally.
Normally I strongly believe we should still be cutting the heads off of royalty. But when you make a movie about this kind of character, you cast him.
Now, yeah. I have to say, I know they mentioned this at the end of the film, but for those that don't know, it's actually based on a novel by Brian Doyle, as they talked about Inside. How did you read the novel and then get inspired to join forces and like co-write it with the author?
Yeah, at the time I was reading a lot of books because I was looking for something that I could turn into a movie. It was before I'd made any movies. I was trying to figure out how to get a movie made. And I met Brian at a party in Los Angeles, and I just really clicked. I just liked him, and he was like, I just moved to LA from New York, I wrote a novel. And so I got the novel that weekend. I read it immediately that weekend, and I called him up on like Monday or Tuesday, and I was like, I want to make this a new movie. Will you give it to me for free? Will you just give me the rights forever? It's a great deal. And he was like, that does sound like a great deal. But he had just moved to LA and wanted to become a screenwriter, so he was like, what if we collaborate on it? And then we started working together, and the collaboration just worked really well. Like, he has kind of a, like, he grew up in the upper West Side in New York, and he had a life that was like similar to some of the characters in the movie. And he's like really well educated, and he has an MFA in writing literature, but he also is always wearing like old vintage Slayer t-shirts. And so in that, you know, we had like so much kind of connection. And we've now written 4 scripts together. We've made 2 movies. This is our second movie we've made together. We've written 2 more. So it was a really good relationship. But it all came together very... Now, this was 7.5 years ago. when that all happened. But the decision to work together and sort of the ease with which we worked happened very quickly.
That's fantastic. Just for those of you out there, if you're interested, the novel is called In This Way I Was Saved. And I haven't read it as of yet. I kind of read like the synopsis of it. I know when you do an adaptation of any kind, it's really what you want to pull and what's going to work for to be a feature. Mm-hmm. So from just a description, I know that it's not that. It's not like 100%. So if someone did read the novel, is going to see, like expect to see that kind of thing happen. It's not going to be that. But I mean, the movie works. Even if you go in blindly, I mean, it tells the story in itself. And I really enjoyed it. It's crazy because I know that this is actually produced by the Spectrovision team, which is Elijah Wood and Daniel Noah and others. And they
and Lisa Whalen and Josh Waller.
Yes. I'm sorry. I'm like, and others. A lady's in there, guys.
Yeah.
Lisa is an amazing producer, and she was on set some of the time we were making the movie, and she always deserves a shout out as well.
Definitely. Shout her out. I lost my train of thought.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you're fine. Interrupt me all day long.
You said
long.
It's produced by Spectrovision.
Yes. So I see that with Mandy, there's kind of they like a lot of psychedelic, like kind of things going on. I kind of try to stay away from that because I'm just like, I think it's going to really fuck with my head. But I really enjoyed what this movie had to do with it. It kind of... I mean, you really, is it like a commentary, social commentary on mental illness? Is it more of a like demon-esque element? I kind of want to lean more towards like, this is a being that's been around for, you know, millennia and has kind of like, as you said in the film, kind of influenced people, and how that influence obviously does not really tend well to the people that he's really looking out to just do terrible things.
Yeah.
So the actors just do a fantastic job, especially when Daniel takes over Luke, and Luke is playing Daniel, and it's like,
It's a little bit of face-off. I don't want to spoil too much for listeners who haven't heard it, but I when I cast Miles, he really wanted to play Daniel. I really wanted him to play Luke, and I knew that, and I had him audition for both roles, and I knew that if he could do both of them, that would make him perfect for playing Luke, because he has to assume so many characteristics of Daniel, and you know, when he gets to, his character gets to change so much, and when he gets to, he was so excited to bring all of these new, you know, things from the other piece of it in.
Yeah, we forgot to say, we do a lot of spoilers, so I forgot to say spoilers for our listeners. They know, like, oh, they're gonna fucking spoil it. You know,
everybody hasn't seen it.
Yeah,
but yeah. The movie, I think, fits very well with the others that the Spectrovision has done, because Mandy and then the other one they're doing, the Colorado Space, are all kind of cosmic, you know, psychedelic in a way, horror, and I think this one fits right in with
it. I mean, I wonder if that's that might be a zeitgeist thing, you know, like obviously I hadn't seen Mandy until after I made this, and I think I think we might just be living in a world where we want to understand our connection, like our personal horrors and like the weirdness of the world and how that's going to be expressed.
Yeah, and it, like I said, it fits in perfectly with all those others, because they all have, you know, a little something to say about people and, you know, how society deals with something they don't quite understand.
Right. The unknowable, the, you know, the bigness, that your problems can feel so huge that they're like an entire, you know, gnarly universe, and Lovecraftian, you know, just you're like, I forgot my keys, and like I can't get a job, and like that can feel like a whole cosmos conspiring against you because it's an evil entity.
Feel like something's personally out to get you.
Yeah.
Now, I saw in the credits that you actually wrote a piece of music. Do you have like a No Gods, No Cats? Do you have a musical background?
I do. I was a musician before I was a filmmaker, and then I was filming bands that was sort of around in my world, and then I started doing music videos for those bands, and that's how, and then I literally gave away all of my musical instruments, and because I was like, if I'm going to be a filmmaker, it's going to be so hard.
Yeah.
I don't want to be distracted by anything else, so I gave away like an electric sitar and a like really just and so I hadn't touched musical instruments. But when I came back from Brooklyn after we shot this movie and we were starting to edit it, I felt like, now I feel like I really am a professional filmmaker, so now I want a hobby. And so I bought a keyboard, I bought like a $99 keyboard, and started like screwing around with making music in a different way than I used to, and I loved it. Like, I would come home at night from editing the movie and just start making music. And so there's, so I have two pieces of music that are in the movie. They're both really kind of in the background. I didn't, you know, but that you know, those two songs came out of this, you know, sort of reinvigorated. So I'm actually going to be putting out a record at the end of the year.
Oh, awesome.
Just like a slab of sort of horror-inspired electronic abyss music.
Okay, we'll definitely keep our eyes out for that. Yeah. Now, we'll go ahead.
I was going to say, you'd mentioned before that, like, obviously Jacob Flatter was kind of an influence on this, and that you said as well, Martyrs. Mm-hmm. Were there some other movies that kind of helped you influence this? Because I noticed a little bit of, like, in some of the effects and stuff, it reminded me of Society.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. In that, there's, like, aspects that are sort of faces manipulated and rubbery things.
It's funny. Bodies twisted.
Yeah. It was really important that Daniel not be depicted sort of, like, ghosty. Like, I didn't want him kind of, like, willowy and walking through walls. Like, it really needed to feel physical. And part of the inspiration for that is, like, it's the manifestation of, like, if Luke's brain is a physical thing, then Daniel is a physical thing. And so what these, like, transformations and things needed to feel really, like, bodily and nervous system-y and gross like that. Yeah, painful. And it's always important, you know, and the opportunity to, like, have actors glue their faces together with real pieces of prosthetics so that they have to interact with that is really attractive. Like, not everything in the movie is practical, and I'm constantly going back and forth between what's digital and what's practical, and hopefully you can't really tell and you're not thinking about that when you watch the movie.
Could not at all.
I don't, like, fetishize prosthetics. Like, it's all prosthetics. Like, so, like, I don't care as long as it works in the movie. But there are times when you really want the actor to, like, grab a big piece of rubber and just deal with it, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you what was digital or what was practical in there. Everything was very seamless looking, and it was all very well done and very creepy. Mm-hmm. Everything that happened when it did, it was kind of one of those, oh, shit, that's uncomfortable.
I was going to say the ladder scene, which I'm not going to say. No spoiler there. But that ladder scene when the doctor's over and I'm like, I was like, holy shit, this is happening. What the fuck?
That was really, I mean, that's obviously the most major spoiler moment in the movie. But it was also, I think that's probably one of my favorite scenes to film. Like, it's, you know, it's really the centerpiece of, like, realizing what's going on.
Yeah, for sure.
The way it's
that's really the turning point of the movie when you know for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I ask everyone this. Our last question is, if you could be part of any horror universe, who or what kind of universe or what universe would that be?
Hmm. Like a universe that exists in movies that we've seen before?
Yes. Yeah. Now, obviously,
I want to be in the Nightmare on Elm Street universe where we've killed Freddy Krueger, and he's fucking done for, and now we've all got cool dream powers and we're just using it to build a more awesome imaginary universe.
Okay.
That's a good answer. I love that. We haven't heard that one before.
No, for real. That's a really good. Yeah, it's like it's a weird question because it's like, well, if I might die, going to pick like random guy from like Friday the 13th.
I'm
going
to be a dream warrior and we're going to wreck that dude
for real. That's great. I would totally be a dream warrior too.
Man, we can all be dream warriors together.
Let's do it.
Well, the song's definitely catchy.
And my last question, which has been on my mind since we met earlier today, when you woke up this morning, Adam, you were like, you know what, this is what I'm gonna wear. Now, no one could see this, but he's sitting here wearing an amazing pink friends t-shirt with the girl, the women cast on it. Tell me the story behind you in this t-shirt.
I'm just such a Phoebe, really. Okay. I mean, I didn't just wake up this morning and I packed it. I flew, I put it, you know, it's the only t-shirt I brought. It's a movie about friends. It's a movie about friendship. Okay. And I thought that this was appropriate. But also, I mean, I am, you know, and I'm wearing a pink hat from Korea with a bunny on it. And I'm wearing flowy white pants. I'm really consciously a little bit trying to deconstruct, like, the style of, like, horror dude, you know? Like, back home in L.A., in my closet, nothing but black jeans and, like, black t-shirts with Evil Dead logo on them. But, like, I feel like I'm ready to sort of express a little bit more color in the world.
I appreciate that. Yeah, for sure. I was like, I know there's a story, behind this because it's magical and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so right on.
It's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
I really
you guys.
Appreciate
this was
meeting
an awesome
you.
Conversation.
And
thank you. Coming out.
I mean, the movie comes out.
It comes out on December 6th.
Okay.
It'll be in some theaters and on VOD and iTunes and all that stuff, like all at the same time. December 6th, we're still working out which theaters it's going to play in, but follow me on Twitter at Adam Egypt, and I'll describe when it comes out.
And are they going to do a Blu-ray release as well?
I hope so. I think we're still talking about that. Okay. I know that in the UK, they're releasing a Blu-ray, and when I go to London next week, I'm going to record some commentaries and stuff like that, but we'll see what the distributor wants to do here. I'm sure eventually there'll be something physical. There better be, because I love
we're big
that.
Collectors of actually having physical media.
Yeah, totally. And this, our artwork is so sick. Like, the guy that did our poster, Jock, is amazing, so I want that to be on a physical object.
Yeah, that needs to be on the shelf.
Yeah. So it'll be out at December 6th, and then Shudder is going to have the exclusive streaming rights. So a couple months after December 6th, it'll be on Shudder, which is, like, you guys must be fans of Shudder.
Oh,
Shudder
we're
is
subscribed.
Awesome.
We love
and
it.
So this means, like, it might not ever be on Netflix. So if you're waiting for it to come on Netflix, you will never see the movie.
Get Shudder.
So you got to either Shudder's buy it on December 6th or go to Shudder
just
in
get
April.
Get Shudder.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's only $5. And if you're a horror fan, it's like, how do you not have Shudder? It's like, I'm not going to say that Netflix is a horror, but I mean,
it's beyond that. It's the Criterion Collection of Horror.
There
you know
you go.
What I mean?
I like that. Yes. Criterion Collection of Horror, Shudder.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you again for coming out.
Thank
we
you,
really
guys.
Appreciate it.
This is awesome.
Stay tuned to The Horror Guys.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.